shops instead of Walmart or Starbucks, community dialogues and youth gatherings instead of mindless entertainment, awareness, not ignorance, connection, not detachment, integrity, not fragmentation. We may choose wrongly. We may miss the turn. We may retreat in the face of the new ground moving beneath us, as well as the alignments of the galaxy and stars. It's in our hands which way we go. Ride the change. Ride the movement. Now we all lean. Trust in the ancient teachings. The life force and energy streams of the universe flow through us all.
That was the group Omeka on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. Omeka is from Los Angeles, and they're on the bill this Saturday at 8 p.m. at Judy's Bar in that event sponsored by the School of America's Watch. And you can get more information at their event page on Facebook or soaw.org. Well, this weekend started with Memorial Day, when U.S. soldiers that have died in battle are honored. And in that remembrance, little to no attention is given to the civilian casualties of war. A recent study estimated that as many as 2 million Iraqis died as a result of the 2003 U.S. invasion. Well, my guest today is Abdul Haq Al-Ani, author of Genocide in Iraq, Volumes 1 and 2. He's an Iraqi-born, British-based barrister who served as a legal advisor on Saddam Hussein's defense to his daughter, Ragat Saddam Hussein. Called to the bar in 1996, he holds a Ph.D. in electronics engineering and a Ph.D. in international law. Founding editor of the Arab Review, he has written widely on culture, politics, and religion. He joined the Ba'ath Party while in his teens, but left it in disappointment a few years later, prior to the Ba'ath Party assuming power in 1968. He is author of The Trial of Saddam Hussein. Welcome to the show, Haq.
Hello. Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine. Thank you for joining me. Well, you know, this is a massive work that you have. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you very well.
Okay, great.
Loud and clear, yes. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Yeah. So you actually, you know, this is a massive work you have, two books, and you actually kind of give the other side of the story than what we normally hear here in the United States and in Europe about Iraq. And you actually say that you talk about genocide, and your two books paint a very clear and stark picture of destruction. But, you know, as this country discusses the Middle East, that term is hardly used, the term genocide I'm talking about. So can you lay out for our listeners the legal outlines of what constitutes genocide and how what the United States or even other member states have done, you know, fits into that description?
Well, genocide was defined in the Genocide Convention 1949, clearly following the Second World War and the Holocaust that befell the Jews in Europe. The purpose was to draw a very clear line about for acts which actually constitute genocide. Most people believe that genocide means simply massive killing. It's not. It's actually borders even on an attempt to eradicate the culture of a nation. Any calculated act that causes physical or mental harm for a nation is genocide. And we submit that in Iraq, between 1990 and up until today, genocide had been committed on a continuous basis, whether during the sanction, whether the invasion, occupation, or following the invasion occupation during the era of the sectarian strife which we witnessed today. It's a continuous process of genocide in which nobody really truly knows how many people have died in Iraq.
As you just mentioned, in your books, you actually point out that what you consider the genocide beginning with sanctions against Iraq that began in 1992, and I think you just mentioned 1990. We know that a 500,000 children died as a result of the sanctions and hunger and lack of medical care. And so what has your research revealed additionally about what officials knew about the impact that they were having, what they knew about the impact of the sanctions? And did they know that they were having this kind of impact at that time?
Well, I mean, it doesn't take a politician or an analyst to realize that if you blockade a country for totally, by which I mean you don't even allow a pencil to get in. You see, once I wanted to send a medical journal to my sister from London to Baghdad, and I was prevented from doing so. This kind of blockade has never been witnessed in history before. We used to study about castles or small towns being blockaded for a few weeks or a few months, and we know what happens. But when you blockade the whole country for 12 years, it's beyond belief that someone doesn't think it is causing genocide. You mentioned 500,000 children. Who knows? This was just a figure once given to the U.S. Secretary of State, and she said it was worth it. But actually, nobody knows how many children died because of lack of medicine, because of malnutrition. Basic medical needs were not allowed into Iraq for 12 years. You can't maintain a nation on smuggling few bits and pieces across the borders when total blockade is imposed, in which every country is taking part. That is actually calculated genocide, plain and simple. Everybody knew that. The United Nations knew that. Every agency of the UN had reports on that. UNICEF, the General Secretary, everybody. If you go back and read the report of the Secretary General, some of which has been documented in our book, if you read those, you know exactly that the United Nations knew what was happening in Iraq, and every member of the Security Council.
You know, actually, in the first book, Destruction of Iraq, you talk about the UN Security Council, and you point the finger at the Security Council and the member states. So why was it important for you to look at the entire UN rather than just the U.S., which was the primary aggressor?
Well, because everybody knows, since 1990, the Security Council has been a rubber stamp of the United Nations. You see, we people in the third world, a year really, really, truly miss the Cold War era, because it was a blessing for us to have the Cold War. The Cold War was a process of checking balances and check on the excesses of either side. Like the Soviet Union was a check on the United States. Since 1990, the United States has been free to do what it likes on the Security Council, especially in the 90s, when Soviet Union was ruled by useless people like Yeltsin and Gorbachev, who could not rule, actually. The United States had a free hand. So the security, when we condemn the United States through the Security Council, we're basically saying the Security Council was not capable of acting independently. We hope that Putin could put his feet down and do something about it. We truly would look forward to that situation. But the Security, let me just point out something which is a misconception among most people. Everybody thinks that the Security Council can do what it likes. Of course it cannot. The Security Council is not above the law. The preemptive rules of international law does not allow the Security Council to impose sanctions or order the killing of people or authorize aggression. This is not possible. This breaches the basic principles of international law on which all the states of the world have contracted. So when we said that the case against the Security Council is made, we say that the Security Council actually itself sanctioned the genocide in Iraq. And it's the first time that anybody has dared to say that the Security Council could be guilty of a crime. But since, and I would like to bring this to everybody's attention, since our book came out, the European Court has ruled, this is first ruling in history, has ruled that the Security Council resolution could be subject to judicial review. Now, this is a first. Okay. This is a first in Europe, and we hope somebody will do something about it. We hope that national governments, national judicial systems, including that of the United States, will heed that basic new change in holding the Security Council to book, so to speak.
So is that underway? Do you know of any individuals, organizations, governments even, that are able to raise these issues? And what judicial body would they go to, The Hague? Or?
Well, anybody actually in Europe if interested. It's a question of money. You see, the judicial system is available, but you really need money to do it. I mean, I give you a very simple example. We took the British government to the High Court accusing Tony Blair and George Bush, two cases actually, one against the United States government and the British government, for war crimes in Iraq. And we were faced with having to put bank guarantees of enormous sums of money, which stopped us proceeding. It's very, very simple. Capitalism is very clever. It gives you an avenue to justice, but it tells you you can only do it if you have the right money. And who's going to raise £1 million of in terms of bank guarantees to cover the possible cost of the other side's legal costs? So we were prevented. Of course, this case which I mentioned, which brought the judgment of the European Court, was made by one Saudi subject who was rich enough to take the case up to the European Court, and his case was very, very simple. His accounts were blocked by the United Nations, by Security Council, and he made a case in the High Court in London that he was not given the opportunity to defend himself, and he won it. He won it in the European Court. The European Court said, yes, of course he had every right to have his case heard. The Security Council is not above the law. The Security Council could make a mistake, and its decision is subject to judicial review. So this opened the gate, so to speak. If anybody wants to follow that same route, it's available. But how many people are capable of, most of the time, the oppressed have no means to take if authorities like the British government or the United States government to court. I mean, who is the United States or the British government short of funds to appoint the best counsel available in the world to defend it? On the other side, the oppressed has gotten nothing but probably his only word in court, which is not sufficient anyway.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm your host, Esther Avaram, and I'm in conversation with Abdul Haq Al-Ani, co-author of Genocide in Iraq, Volumes 1 and 2. As I said before, the subtitle for the first book, which we're talking about now, is The Case Against the UN Security Council in Member States. And the subtitle for the second book, which we'll talk about after the break, is The Obliteration of a Modern State. So we'll continue the discussion after this break when we'll hear another cut from Omeka. And you can join the discussion by calling 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893 to join the discussion about the obliteration of a modern state, the destruction of Iraq. But more importantly, on my final day of the spring membership drive, you can call 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739, or go online to wpfwfm.org and help the station to continue to bring you alternative progressive voices to the air here in the DMV. And if you go online, click the donate button and make sure you select Thursday's Community Watch and Comment on the drop-down menu. We're offering these two books together as a package for you today for a pledge of only $75 or at least a $10 a month member subscription for a new or renewing member. So we will go to a break right now and stay on the line, Haq, and we'll be right back.
The first place we build alternatives is in our minds and in our hearts. Because our minds have been colonized. And the minute you can free your mind, all kinds of possibilities open up.
Shiva, furnitures by the people. Furnitures by Sevilla. Furnitures by the movement. Furnitures by Shiva.
Feminist activist, philosopher, thinker, analyst. We moralize through scholarship. Science is narrowed by scientists. Critics say she's alarmist. My people are home, it's in danger. So what else can anyone call this? I place value in diversity, natural originality. Let the seed remain a mystery. Maintain nature's integrity. This isn't simply to feed, but a future guaranteed. All right to exist and proceed. Move ahead, let the children lead. Let the people plant seed and save. Let the people grow the next wave. We the people want the same thing. Our future to be saved. But foreign policy, forging allies, enforcing policies, land is privatized. Consistent atrocities, police brutality, that's a reality realized. Constitutions rewritten, land stolen, people displaced, man, free trade agreements, systemic oppression. You wonder why there is migration?
Shiva, the people.
Towards democracy, because I do think the next step of human freedom will only come out of a larger freedom for all life on Earth. This is only when we set all species free will the last human being be free. And so Earth's democracy is about the democracy of life. But it's also a democracy of everyday living. Of everyday living.
Democracy, people's wisdom and ancestry, cultural, traditional, I inherit this legacy, plant the seed. Freedom ain't no private property, that's what's through patriarchy. If freedom is only bound to man, let me live in a matriarchy. I'm living in a mothership, restore humanity, restore our dignity, reclaim our Earth citizenship. Sin Sharu Kala Chiapas, US all the way to China, big globalized markets, why not? Globalize the struggles, like diversify actions, pollinate movements, like grains and seeds were plenty. Looking up, Dania, truly, what some small multiplied by many.
Shiva, by the people.
And welcome back to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition for May 28, 2015 on WPFW Washington, 89.3, your station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Rivera. I'm here on our fourth and final week of the spring membership drive for On the Ground. And that was the group Omeka you heard over the break. So before the break, I was speaking with Abdulhaq Al-Ani, author of Genocide in Iraq, Volumes 1 and 2. The subtitle for the first book is The Case Against the UN Security Council and Member States, and the subtitle for the second book, which we'll discuss now, is The Obliteration of a Modern State. And Haq is staying with us to continue the discussion, and you can join us at 202-588-0893. To also join the discussion and to support the station and On the Ground's goal for today and the membership drive, you can call 202-588-9739 or go online to wpfw.org. So, Haq, the current state of Iraq, I think, you know, has its roots obviously in the starting with the sanctions in the 90s, and then our invasion in 2003. And then, so in the second book, this is what you deal with after the invasion. Can you talk about perhaps the things that we don't know about? You mentioned Paul Bremer's role, as, you know, put there to kind of oversee the coalition, you know, after the invasion. And what in particular did he do to kind of jumpstart the destruction or continue the destruction that has only worsened to today?
He did everything required to dismantle the state. The first regulation he issued on the day of arrival to Iraq, he declared that he and he alone was the sole of executive, judicial, and legislative power in the country. There's never been in the history of Iraq, even Saddam Hussein, the dictator himself, never declared that he had the authority in his hand. The second order he made was to dismantle every single apparatus of the state. He dissolved the army, the police, the security, the secret service. Imagine for one day that in New York tomorrow has no police force. What do you think is going to happen? This is exactly what Bremer did in all Iraq, not in Baghdad, in all Iraq. Iraq, in one day, was without any authority. His army was only positioned in place to protect itself. The people took the law to their hands. This is a country that had gone through 20 years of war, deprivation of 12 years. You can imagine what happened. Every group of people carried arms and took the law to their hands. And what we witness today is was actually started in 2003, in March 2003. This is a very, very natural consequence of Paul Bremer did. And Paul Bremer was not an idiot. It was all fully calculated to bring about the destruction and the division of Iraq. What we witness today is free Iraq turning into three countries. When we hear senators talking about dividing Iraq, Joe Biden himself mentioned that. This is not an accident. This is a very calculated process. It dates back to the project for Iraq, which was initiated by the State Department of the CIA in following the 9/11 to prepare Iraq, as they called it, the post-Saddam era. And it was decided then and there that if you could not rule Iraq directly as you rule Saudi Arabia or any of the GCC Gulf, then you should divide into Iraq into three parts and let the idiots fight among themselves.
The book, the first book is dealing with the period from the 90s, maybe up to 2003. And it's talking about genocide in a way that people don't only normally think about it. Like you said before the break, people think of genocide as mass killing, but there can be indirect killing through the withdrawal of medical supplies, the inability for people to get medical care, proper nutrition, food. And we already know from independent studies that at least 500,000 Iraqi children died. After 2003, we're talking about, I know recently there was an estimate that at least 2 million Iraqis have died since 2003 because of the U.S. invasion. So when we start talking about the genocide in these two different periods, we're talking about obviously two different types of killing. What did your research in your second book reveal to you that you didn't know about what has happened in Iraq?
I have never had any doubt about what has been happening in Iraq, because I have been following Iraq all my life, even though I spent a lot of my life outside Iraq, as I do now. But I have been in touch with events on the ground. The purpose of the book was to present to those people who don't have the same access to that. So nothing of my research, nothing in the research surprised us. But it suffices to say that today, according to the United Nations, the direct effect of the invasion and occupation resulted in 2 million people killed in Iraq, 4 million displaced. The Iraqi Human Rights Ministry has come up with a figure that there are 2.5 million orphans in Iraq since the invasion. Now, you can imagine how did these people, most of those orphans, caused by the one member of the parents killed, mostly men, of course, killed during that era. And now, as I said earlier, nothing is separate from the previous event. The sanctions started in 1990, caused destruction and killing and genocide in more than one form, then followed by the invasion and occupation, which resulted in massive destruction and death. Then we had an era of sectarian war in 2006.
Yeah, I know that's a whole. Yeah, let's.
2007.
Let's take a little break here. I do have a caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Tesfa from Arlington.
Good morning, Tesfa.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. The doctor.
Alani.
You documented your case with real evidence, and the witnesses are the people of the world. We all saw the children in Iraq die because of lack of medicine and lack of good water.
Right.
In Ethiopia, the government of the United States installed killed 400 people in western Ethiopia because they wanted the flat land through which rivers run. If you go to Kenya, you will find 50,000 of those people who took refuge because of that genocide. And also the Ethiopian government tells the Amharas, the Guragis, the Afars, the Anuaks, the Orthodox Christians, the Ethiopian Muslims on which it installed a new version of Islam, and it's trying to wipe out every religious group.
Okay. Well, Tessa, thank you for always adding that extra dimension to our discussions. So we're talking about Iraq this morning, and we are talking about these two books, Genocide in Iraq, The Obliteration of a Modern State. And there's actually two volumes, and we have them available as our thank you gift. And I think I have someone to thank. Up here, Anonymous from Williamsburg, Virginia. Thank you so much. And I will just thank you so much. And if you would like to join Anonymous, call 202-588-9739, or 1-800-222-9739, or go online to wpfwfm.org to also make your pledge in this final week and final day for On the Ground raising funds to support this type of coverage, highlighting the voices of activists, activism, and across a wide variety of subjects and a wide variety of causes that affect us. You know, this is about human rights and, you know, our lives. So we want to have a voice here, right here in the DMV, right here in DC, to raise our voice and so that those in power, in quotation marks, can hear us. I'm speaking to Abdulhaq Al-Ani this morning, author of Genocide in Iraq, Volumes 1 and 2. And we're talking about the second book right now, which kind of deals with the United States invasion of Iraq since 2003 and the impacts since then. So the some United States, you know, legal minds have rejected the basis you claim for genocide, and they raise this issue of intent. And you bring this out in your book, and you're saying that you're pointing out the flaws in their argument. So can you talk about, you know, your response to their rejecting the basis for calling for, you know, indicating that there was genocide in Iraq?
I think, you see, it's a red herring, really. Those people who hang on to the fine meaning of intent, to trying to obviate that kind of come and say, look, even if it's not genocide, what do they want to classify it as? Aggression? Aggression has been classified in the Nuremberg Tribunal as the most heinous.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And
let's define it as a crime. Call it what you like. It's not genocide. How would those legal minds in the United States want to describe the invasion, occupation, and subsequent crimes committed in Iraq? Is it war crime? Is it crime against humanity? Is it aggression? Any of the three crimes defined in the International Criminal Court statute, fine with me. If they don't want to apply the fourth category, which is genocide, I will settle for that. I don't mind what it's called. But let's agree that there was a heinous crime committed in Iraq since 1990. Do they agree on that?
Right.
Let's forget about the definition of intent and what is required. I'm sorry, but this is actually diverting the whole argument. Someone trying to say, oh, hold on a minute, because we are not sure about intent. Is anybody with the slightest common sense, forget about legal argument. I don't want to enter into legal argument. Listen, ordinary people don't want the legal argument. It's common sense. Is anybody with the right state of mind, the least of common sense, would say that the United States and Britain did not start the blockade and invasion on Iraq bent on killing people? Is anybody with the slightest common sense not conclude that total blockade leads to massive destruction and killing?
Right. We actually have some of the same issues here domestically in the United States when there are, for example, cases of police brutality or cases of discrimination, and the law is set up so that you have to somehow prove intent. And the of course, that's impossible to do because you have to be inside that person's mind to say, okay, well, they did not intend to, you know, kill this person in cold blood, or they didn't intend to discriminate against them when they did certain acts. So I know that intent in the law can be a tricky thing and kind of a deceptive thing. But I wanted...
Even if they did not have the intent on destroying Iraq in 1990, by 1995, everybody in the world, including the Security Council, knew that blockade was causing genocide. Even if you did not start with it, halfway through the sanctions, you would have had enough evidence to prove it. If I give them the benefit of the doubt and say they did not start with intent, then they could not sustain that argument for the 12 years. I'm sorry, but the Security Council, the United Nations reports were clear by the time they had the Oil for Food Agreement in 1995. It was specifically because the United Nations said enough people are dying around the clock because there's no money to buy food for the Iraqis. How could anybody say there was no intent after that?
Right. Now, the other thing that I wanted you to cover in the time we have left, we only have a couple minutes left, but you treat the Ba'ath movement in Iraq differently than how it is normally treated by news organizations in Europe and here in the U.S., where it's, you know, typically depicted as a despotic, kind of tyrannical political sect, and the Ba'ath Party is kind of demonized as the reason actually why it was okay for us to invade Iraq. So what do you think is the Ba'ath side of the story? I know that before our invasion, you know, there were Iraq had one of the highest levels of, you know, living standards. Women had rights. You know, they could be educated. It was a very modern state. So, what is the other side of the coin when we look at the Ba'ath Party?
I will briefly outline this. The only two secular states in the Middle East Arab world, Iraq and Syria, they both ruled by the Ba'ath. The Ba'ath movement is the educated intelligentsia of the Arab Middle East who wanted independence, wanted their freedom to decide their life, how they live it. Socialists, freedom, whatever it is. They actually built the only two secular states in which everybody, forget about despotic definition and all that. The only despotic state in the whole Arab world is Saudi Arabia, and they get red carpet treatment in Washington. It's despicable to grant the most despotic rulers in the world that treatment. Has anybody ever talked about despotic Saudi Arabia, where there's no constitution, no human rights, no parliament, no elected body, no society, no organization? People get whipped for having a tweet, for heaven's sake. At least there's not a single church in all of Arabia. Iraq and Syria had the oldest established churches, and the Christians, not as a generosity of the Ba'ath rule, but it's because they're natural right. They lived the best life in the whole Middle East under the Ba'ath rule. Why is the American and the Europeans antagonistic to the Ba'ath? Do you know why? I tell you why. It's not because they are despotic. It's not because they oppress their people. The only simple reason is that they are against Israel. Plain and simple. Every country in the Middle East that is a friend of Israel is acceptable. Every country that is antagonistic in enmity with Israel is rejected. You have to demonize them in order to justify your actions against them. Now, what we have in Iraq and Syria, sectarian wars with an Islamic State on the horizon, is that what the United States and Europe want to bring to the Middle East? Prehistoric age. Our third book is going to be Genocide in Iraq, the Rise of the Islamic State. We're going to talk about the era of the rise of the Islamic State, which is again connected to the invasion occupation, which is itself connected to the sanction. There's a continuous process. We're going to have the third era, which talks about how genocide has been committed by the Islamic factions, the so-called Islamic factions.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to thank my guest, author Abdulhaq Alani, for talking to us today about his two books, Genocide in Iraq, and there are two volumes, The Case Against the Security Council Member States, and the second one, The Obliteration of a Modern State. Thank you so much, Haq, for joining me this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And that will do it for us on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Averam, and again, I want to thank my guest, Abdulhaq Alani, and thank you so much for listening and for calling in and supporting your station for Jazz and Justice. You can keep calling in and join Anonymous from Virginia and get our special gift today, Genocide in Iraq, or also you can still get our thank you gift from the last 2 weeks, White Like Me, Race, Racism, and White Privilege in America, and you can call 202-588-9739 to get that gift, or to pledge and to get that thank you gift, or you can go online to WPFWFM.org. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. If you'd like to work on the show, we have openings for volunteers and interns, and you can reach us at onthegroundshow.org. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice. Peace.